What a year it's been. This time last year, Australia was heading into its first recession in decades and the steepest recession in, I don't know, 80 years. Yet last week, the Australian Bureau of Statistics confirmed the strength of Australia's economic rebound. In fact, it was the fastest economic recovery from a recession in 45 years. In fact, we're one of the only three countries where our economy is ahead of where it was at the beginning of the coronavirus pandemic. But today, Ken Race and I unpack the statistics and explain what's going on. We talk about the truth behind Australia's economic recovery. But don't worry if you're not into economic jargon. My chat today with Ken Race, who's Australia's leading property tax strategist and a lifelong student of economics, it'll be in plain English, and we'll unpack what's going on so you understand what's ahead, both the good and some of the headwinds that may slow us down. So at the end of today's podcast, you're going to be able to make better informed investment, financial, and business decisions. What you'll be hearing today is a portion of a private webinar that we conducted for the attendees of Wealth Retreat 2021 to give them some insights before they join us. And while you won't be able to see the slides, I'm sure our description will be sufficient for you to get benefit from our chat. So welcome to today's podcast.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment, and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropol, who specialize in helping you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now, here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's authority in wealth creation through property, who has been voted one of Australia's top 50 most influential thought leaders.
Well, Ken, Australia's impressive economic recovery from COVID-19 was confirmed recently when Australian Bureau of Statistics showed us that we had a really strong economic recovery, 1.8% rise in the March GDP. So this followed the 3.2% rise in the December quarter and 3.5% in the September quarter. So what that means is our economic output now, Ken, is higher than it was before the COVID recession. And that was, of course, because of easy money policy, booming commodity prices, demand for our resources were rampant, especially with the Chinese economy. But that's another problem. Maybe we can talk about it. And of course, all the fiscal stimulus the government gave us, that all played a part. But Ken, today, what I'd like to actually have a chat with you about is some of the broader indicators, not just the GDP and what's really going on in our economy. So welcome to this session, Ken.
Thank you, Michael. And maybe as a bit of background for our listeners, GDP is the sum value of everything we produce in this country. And while we see a relatively small number, 1.8% growth in the March quarter, that represents well over $30 million, almost $33 billion more of activity. So a small 1.8% generates $33 billion.
Sure. Well, I think that was a great way to start explaining what GDP is. So what we're talking about really is the recent results that came out, which were for the March quarter. So that was really when we still had JobKeeper, we had enhanced employment benefits. At that stage, there were no lockdowns. And what that really meant was Australia did roar out of recession. The figures were only just released now, but it showed that we're doing very nicely. And that means that over the previous year, we'd grown 8% over the previous actually three quarters. But we had that terrible collapse. It was only really one quarter. It was a tiny blip in the March quarter last year, then that big 7% drop. But the net result is that our economy's doing better than most advanced countries. We've done pretty nicely, Ken. But a lot of people suggest that that's not the only way to look at how our economy is going. So I'd like to have a bit of a chat about jobs, about pay, about personal expenditure, business expenditure. So the first chart here shows what's happened over the long term. What is the government aiming at? What are they hoping to get with the GDP?
What they're trying to do is stimulate the economy enough that we start employing more people. Now, as you said a few minutes ago, the March quarter was really while there was still JobKeeper and JobSeeker, and people thought we would fall off the precipice when that stopped. The recent unemployment figures are really not evidencing that. There's strong employment numbers. Yes, there's still just over 5% of people unemployed, but that means there's nearly 95% of people employed. And people were expecting those numbers to deteriorate with the loss of JobKeeper and JobSeeker. So those employment numbers have improved, which actually shows businesses, consumers are actually got their confidence back and they are going back into the shops. The shops are selling more. And I think you've got some other slides later on that'll actually show that confidence factors by the bosses, if I can call them that.
Well, it's interesting because the Reserve Bank was expecting, our government forecasts were expecting unemployment to remain high for a while and not get down to the level we just recently released for another 12 months. So it's moved ahead. But I think this chart, and I've got to give credit to Michael Matusik for this, was an interesting example because what it actually shows is the quarterly growth compared to the long-term trend. And clearly our long-term trend is upwards. But if we didn't have this recession, if we didn't have the downturn that we had, the government, the economy would have actually performed much better. So the suggestion is there could even be a $100 million hole, a loss that we missed out on last year because of this. So even though we are currently doing well, and we should be thankful for that, there is a loss that can't be recouped. And it's also come at a cost, Ken, because the government has spent a lot of money to get us to this position.
Correct. And the other side of the coin is they've spent a lot of money to keep the economic activity levels high. But had they not, what would have been the cost to the economy with, dare I say, unemployment benefits, businesses going bankrupt, people's mental health going down, et cetera, et cetera. So while there is a financial loss, we've really got to say, but what did that save on the other side of the coin?
I fully agree with that. So it's the government's job to look after us and provide hospitals and provide politicians, maybe they should, and other services, but it's also to keep us well. And so therefore they've spent money and some are saying, oh, that's a Ponzi scheme, Ken. What they've done is they've propped up the property market, but they also realise that if we feel safe and secure in our homes and our castles, we're going to have that wealth effect that's already showing and we're going to spend more. And so it really isn't a Ponzi scheme. It's their job to look after our interests.
That's right. And look, as a normal household, if you have reduced income, if one of the bread earners loses their job, you tap into your savings or you use your credit card a little bit more, knowing that when the job or the hours come back, you'll then reduce that debt. And then so it's effectively just a safety net that you periodically use and then replenish. And that's what some of the other charts I think you'll be talking about with savings ratios, that actually is a reflection of exactly that point.
So really what's happened is that it's been government expenditure up till now. Now businesses are starting to come in that has actually got us through. This particular chart shows that private expenditure is on the lower side and it's really been driven by government spending.
That's right. And when we look at it, what does that mean? During COVID and in times of economic uncertainty, people delve into their stock levels. They sell out of stock. So they don't make more stuff. You know, they reduce their workload. They tap into their reserves. What we're now seeing is an uplift in that manufacturing side of business by expenditure in capital, which really is the confidence factor that business see as people will buy our goods and services, so we will invest to make more.
Now, the other thing we look at, so it's not just GDP, we're also looking at employment, and it's not just how many people are employed, because we know the unemployment figures are a little bit, well, I don't want to use the word fudged, but you're considered employed if you're working 1 or 2 hours a week rather than totally unemployed. This chart shows that clearly the public sector jobs continued on really well, but private sector jobs disappeared last year.
But boy, have they picked up, and most of the jobs have come back. Now, that doesn't mean there are not people still unemployed in the travel industry, in the tourism, in the hospitality industry, but other jobs have been created to make up for that overall.
That's right. And I think this chart really starkly shows what a lot of people have been talking about, a two-tiered economy, the public sector and the private sector. And really, it's the private sector that's borne the brunt of this economic downturn. And we're now looking to them to build it back up again because, you know, as much as the public sector's grown slightly, we're actually expecting and hoping for quite a significant turnaround in that private sector to take us now back above public sector. Because hopefully we do have more private sector workers than government workers.
You'd really hope so, wouldn't you? That's right. But having said that, wages growth has been low for quite some time. The government's on a lot about that, isn't it? And overall, the public sector wages have increased a little bit more. So wages have gone up a tiny bit, about 1.5, 1.6% over the last year. But the government would like them higher than that. What's behind that, Ken?
Look, I think people feel that with reducing wage rates, they've got less purchasing power. And what we've seen is with migration, particularly in some of those earlier years compared to 2021, migration levels were going up, automation was increasing, so there was less and less need for labour, and therefore wages went down. They weren't going up as much. So what they're hoping to do is with less labour in the workforce, more demand, those wages will start growing. But the converse again is, and I'm a bit of a contrarian in this, we've got to compare that to, yes, our wage rate growth has slowed, but people in the early years of that chart were paying 17% interest rates. They're now paying 3% on their home. What did you pay for a car? What did you pay for travel? So the actual bang for your buck in a lot of cases has actually increased, notwithstanding a lower wage growth. But it is a neon sign that people cling to when they say, but my wages haven't been growing.
Well, why should wages grow? One reason is because of inflation. In other words, if the cost of bread and milk and petrol goes up, we would like to be able to buy as much with our wages. But the other is productivity. If you improve your ability to make more, to work more productively, then I guess you should get paid. But there hasn't been much of an increase in productivity. On the other hand, there hasn't really been much inflation. So when wages growth was much higher, that had to occur because of the higher inflation rates.
That's right. And one of the levers that the Reserve Banks has is interest rates. And if they start seeing high inflation, which is going to be partly driven by wage growth, then they actually will start increasing interest rates. And then that'll have the effect of trying to dampen the economy again. So it's like driving with one foot on the brake and one foot on the accelerator. And it's which do you release, you know, the most at any point in time?
Now, last year, most of us weren't very confident. We weren't sure what's ahead with our economy, with our jobs, with our businesses, with our health. So Australians saved a lot. And the household saving rate really jumped up. We paid down credit card debts. We paid down our mortgages. But as confidence returned in the second half of last year and into this year, we're starting to spend a little bit more.
Yeah, I think this is one of the most telling economic charts for the Australian economy. When we're saving at 5%, it really doesn't give us, you know, much latitude for when things go wrong. So once we started seeing falling interest rates, people started paying off credit cards, they started saving. Money was going into super. So all of a sudden, we saw these savings rates go up. And one of the biggest things that we rely on the world for as an Australian economy is overseas capital. We don't have enough of our own money to invest here, so we've got to borrow that money from external sources. So we're not generating that interest income to locals. So that higher interest rates allows us then to source more of that money locally. We've had to tap into it because of COVID. People didn't work as much. They lost their jobs. So they tapped into that. So it's good to see that now stabilizing. It's the downward trend is just marginal. And then hopefully it'll kick off again. That's really the trend. And certainly on a personal level, I want to see that number start climbing back up to that 25% rate, if only to have a shock absorber in case something happens and to have more money in the Australian economy to draw on to invest.
Well, the huge war chest Australians have saved is what gives me a level of confidence that the economy is going to pick up, because as we start feeling comfortable, more of us are going to feel we deserve to have that new holiday, the new house, the new clothes, because we've had a difficult year or two, and that's going to make the economy turn around, isn't it?
That's correct.
Now, over the long term, though, this chart shows what's happened to our economy, and the net result of that little blip last year hasn't really spoiled Australia's exemplary long-term growth. It means we're almost alone amongst developed nations, along with South Korea and probably New Zealand, whose figures aren't out yet, that we're better off after COVID than we were before.
That's right. And certainly that line is back on trend. And other than, you know, in that early 1980s when we had a similar dip, but not as deep, I mean, this is why people say COVID-19 is this once in a century catastrophe. And, you know, nobody expected it to last as long. I mean, it's really almost 2 years that this will take to come out of the system. But at this early stage, we're now above pre-pandemic levels.
And this suggests that we've entered the recession with 5.8% more buying power than we started with. I know some people are going to say, no, that's not me. But in general, Australians are wealthier than they started off the recession with.
That's right. And what makes that chart, I think, even more pleasing is it's the per capita number. So, yes, we've seen in absolute terms GDP grow. But when we say how much per person, which is the per capita number, that's going up. And when we look at the high migration levels, et cetera, then that's really been the boost. So more people have had more money, as opposed to the same pot shared.
Well, currently there is that savings there and people are still a little bit reluctant to spend, but consumer spending is bouncing back and that's good. And that's just a different chart showing the household savings ratio, which is in good shape at the moment, having dropped just a little bit. But I'd like to actually now move forward, because I think we have a lot to be thankful for, to be appreciative of. We're very lucky. So let's go through seven reasons why you and I can think we're optimistic about the future. And I've got to give Dr. Shane Oliver, the chief economist of AMP Capital, credit for some of these charts. And one of the things is that we're still, as I started to say, in much better position than the rest of the world as a starting point. But the vaccines are coming out a little bit slower than we'd hoped, but it is underpinning the reopening of Australia, hopefully the reopening of our borders and economic recovery. As the uncertainty of outbreaks diminishes, I think we're going to feel more comfortable moving forward.
I think so, especially that Australia is now going to start manufacturing and has started manufacturing our own vaccines. And, you know, once we start introducing the technologies for the Pfizer type shots, because they're two different technologies for the major vaccines, then we're actually going to have our own vaccines. Because really what people are talking about is it's almost like the flu shot that we're going to need every year. So next year, when people want that third shot, if I can call it that, then if we have our own, then we won't be reliant on those imports and at the whim of other countries, other jurisdictions, other manufacturers.
Who would have thought this time last year that there would be vaccines out already? Remember, they were talking about it'll take 5 years, 10 years. It's amazing what technology's done. And I must admit, Pam and I've had our first dose, had no issues at all. I know some people have had flu-y sort of symptoms. And so I'm feeling more comfortable having been protected. And I'm looking forward to being able to travel more because of it. And we're looking at other reasons why we are confident about the future. I think the global recovery is improving as well, driven by vaccines, driven by the reopening of borders. And that's going to be important for us, especially for our exports and our commodity prices.
Yeah, that's a very interesting chart. It's people don't really talk about PMI. It's really the Purchasing Managers Index. So this gets back to the grassroots of the purchasing managers at the manufacturing sites. What do they anticipate buying as raw materials? And obviously, the more confident they are with growth and with the economy, the more likely they're going to be saying, we're going to be buying more raw materials. And that 50% line, really for a developed economy such as Australia, really says that's a flat line. GDP would be, growth would be about zero. So we really want to see that line well above 50 to give us that confidence that the manufacturing side of the world has got confidence and therefore buying raw materials, because a lot of the raw materials need stockpiles and people want stockpiles to take them through a long period of time. So they need that high level of confidence. And that's showing that that's certainly starting to occur.
That's good news. As we look for further good news in the world, consumer spending currently is starting to pick up, but there's also our property markets and building approvals and finance pre-approvals all suggesting that currently the construction industry and the building industry and the real estate industry is going to help our economy. Now, clearly, that was part of the government's aim with all those building incentives, first homeowner incentives. Really wasn't for the first home buyers. It was to keep the construction industry going. And I was interested to see when we broke down the GDP, what created our economy to improve over the last little while. A large part of that was due to stamp duty and renovations, wasn't it?
That's right. I mean, construction activity is seen as the devil by some and as the angel and savior by others. It's really the tap. That's one of the main economic taps for the Australian economy. That when they want activity to grow, they turn on the construction tap because that means more employment. We tend to use Australian raw materials, you know, when we're talking about infrastructure for the roads, the cement, the gravel, the sand. And then when we want to shut down economic activity, they sort of turn off that construction tap again. That's why we see that those housing numbers, I suppose, so sensitive to economic activities and the government levers. That's one of the easiest tools they have to stimulate or the converse of that, reduce economic activity, because the flow-through effect is so big. You build a house, you need carpets, you need washing machines, you need the gardeners to come in, painters. So a very, very long list of activities that are taken up.
Okay, just looking at what we feel comfortable moving forward, overall, consumer confidence is high as well. And that's really important. If people aren't confident about their jobs, they're not confident about their financial future, they're not going to spend. And that's what happened last year when they were saving. But at the moment, there's all the positive news. The share market's doing well, ultra low interest rates, and all that's suggesting that we're going to be spending more in the absence of any major changes to the pandemic. The wealth effect is starting to kick in without us feeling more comfortable that our houses are even worth more. I mean, the wealth effect's a big factor, isn't it?
It certainly is, because at the end of the day, people know that if the only asset they have in retirement is the home, if that's worth a lot more, they know that they can downsize. And with recent government policy to allow people to put money into super when they sell their home based on certain requirements, then at least they know they can sell their house, move into aged care, move into a smaller house, although the smaller house isn't necessarily always cheaper, but putting that aside. So that home is the big savings bank for a lot of people. That's why it's so sensitive for most of us to see and feel that house price is going up.
So we talked a lot about consumers spending, buying houses, buying cars, but businesses starting to invest as well. You said a moment ago that they work down their inventory? Of course they would. I mean, if you're a clothing shop, would you have bought much stock for winter last year if you weren't sure that people were going to come out? If you were a manufacturer, would you have made much more if you knew people weren't going to be buying your goods? But business investment, business expenditure, partly encouraged by government incentives, is starting to pick up now.
Absolutely. And people, I think, are seeing the signs of the other side of COVID. Yes, Australia, there's different points of view as to the rollout timing, but we're now starting to see people joining the queue, if I can put it that way, to get their COVID shots. And like you, I've had my first shot. And even if we were to say, is there any silver lining to this recent outbreak in Victoria? It has pushed well over 100,000 people in the last day or two to go and get their shots for the first time. So I think that will spur more and more people to get their vaccines, which then will lead to more opening up of the Australian economy and then hopefully the world economy.
That's all good signs. And as we work through a number of the reasons why we believe that good times are ahead, there's still fiscal stimulus from the government. So we're not going to be able to have lower interest rates. That's not going to happen. The Reserve Bank's not going to lower them. So it's now really up to the government to encourage people to create jobs, to make the economy keep moving, for businesses to keep going.
Yeah, I mean, you know, at 0.1% interest rates, and then we see that converting into the 2-3% for most people housing rates, and some people obviously can get a lower interest rate than that. There's just so much you can do there. What we need is sustainable activity, which is jobs, which is all about creating stimulus so people have got the confidence to spend into manufacturing plant and equipment, into services, to grow the production side to meet the demand side. That's really what sustains the Australian economy and any other economy in the world, I think, long term. And that's why I think the government is focusing so much on making sure companies stay afloat so that they can then reignite their activities and to put enough stimulus to create, can I say, new entrepreneurs to open up new businesses.
Well, that's really important because, unfortunately, some small businesses will fall by the wayside, not their own fault. It's just too hard to remain in business when you've got to keep shutting down, as we have particularly in Victoria. So we don't want to make it hard for new entrepreneurs. We want a whole new generation of people to help grow our economy. So while this government fiscal stimulus, there will still be comfortable monetary policy. It's going to remain ultra easy for a while. The Reserve Bank has said over and over again, or the governor of the Reserve Bank and the deputy governor, Guy DeBell, as well, has said, no, we're not going to raise interest rates for a number of years. And it's not a long period of time. It really has to do with inflation starting to pick up, unemployment being down low enough to have wages rise. But the media is scaring us and saying, no, interest rates are going to go up again. They're worried about quantitative easing, creating hyperinflation, or the government taking away the Reserve Bank taking away some of its supportive measures for the bank. The Reserve Bank's come out over and over again saying, no, we're not going to raise interest rates.
That's it. I mean, the other brick that they put on people was the ability to get credit. So there's responsible lending rules. You know, people were talking about should that be relaxed? But most people are getting the loans they want. So at this stage, you know, they're not relaxing.
No, that sort of went off the radar, didn't it? Because that was going to happen. But it's not necessary, is it?
It's not necessary. So that's going to be a lever that they've got up their sleeve, as opposed to printing more money or reducing interest rates. Making it easier for the banks to approve loans within, obviously, a level of safety, comfort, and we don't want to push people into debt that is definitely not affordable.
Sorry to talk over. Currently, the Reserve Bank's not worried, and APRA's not worried, because up till now, the vast majority of the new loans taken out have been to owner-occupiers, many to renovate their homes, to improve their homes, to refinance, others to buy new homes. But owner-occupiers in general are not really speculating. And there's actually very, very few defaults. We haven't fallen off the cliff. All those people who deferred their loans are now repaying them again. Yeah. So the Reserve Bank has no reason to change their stance, and APRA really has no reason to interfere at present.
At present. And then we're seeing the overflow into business loans. Yeah. So, you know, maybe that's a bit slower than some people would have wanted, but there is increasing activity in those business loans. Yes, the banks might be taking people's homes as security, but that's because there's equity in the home.
Yeah, yeah.
To make the bank feel comfortable. So people have got access to those funds, I think, for business. And that's another area that I think the government's got that lever that they could stimulate a bit more if they need to in the coming months. And
so there's a number of reasons why we're feeling confident and comfortable moving forward. But clearly there are headwinds or potential headwinds ahead. So we're not blind to those. Economic growth should continue this year and it should remain strong and will continue into next year, but may slow down a little bit. And that's what the government and the Reserve Bank's forecasting. But it will depend upon a couple of external factors that I guess are out of their control. I mean, one of them, Ken, is further coronavirus outbreaks. And hopefully that's going to happen less as the vaccines roll out. And I guess a lot will depend upon when our borders open, because once we get international tourists, once we get students back, they're two big sectors of our economy that are currently suffering badly.
Correct. And a lot of that GDP growth has been driven on the back of, can I say, some exports, Australian coal, Australian iron ore. And, you know, those prices, if you like, have almost doubled in a year to unprecedented levels. So there is a lot of demand for our raw materials, if you like, around the world, which the companies are then selling, making a profit, which is then feeding into government coffers. So even if that goes down a bit, you would hope that these other areas, such as immigration of students, normal immigration, et cetera, will start to fill that gap.
One of the big risks one has to at least consider is the geopolitical risk emanating from Australia's strained relationship with China.
Yeah, Australia exports to China at a level equal to the next three export countries. So there is a wide gap between number one and certainly number two, three, and four. And number two, three, and four, as I said, are about the size of China. So I think this has been a wake-up call that Australia needs to diversify its customer base. And I think also increase the types of products and services we manufacture so that we're not held to ransom in these times of uncertainty.
Well, I think we have started to learn that. There's talk about a free trade agreement with the United Kingdom that now, of Britain, now that it's not part of the EU, that may happen later this year. We are selling a lot of our commodities elsewhere. It's interesting, China is taking a lot of our iron ore. We know that, and we know it's because it's growing. I heard a pessimist suggest if you were planning to go to war, Ken, if you were planning to build more submarines and boats and tanks and armory, you'd want to stockpile on your iron ore and steel before you went into that mode. I hope that's not the case.
I hope that's not the case as well.
So all in all, isn't it interesting that we are sitting here today talking about how well our economy is performing? Who would have thought that 12 months ago, even 6 months ago? So we are in the lucky country. So thank you, Ken. That's giving us a great insight into what's ahead. And I think the listeners of today's podcast, which was an audio track of a special presentation we did for the attendees of Wealth Retreat. So unfortunately, the people listening to the podcast didn't have a chance to see the slides, but I hope our descriptions were enough to help them understand it. I think now people are also getting to understand the depth of your knowledge and experience. In other words, while you are Australia's leading property tax strategist. You've got financial planning background. You've got business background in real business, big businesses and small. And if people are wanting to get a wealth plan, if people are wanting to get the right ownership structures, if people are wanting to make sure that they can protect their assets so they can pass them on to future generations, I encourage them to go to metropole.com.au and have a look at your wealth advisory services and the services you and your team provide. Who are the main sort of clients that you help through Metropole Wealth Advisory?
I think they fall into a couple of categories: business owners, professionals, and property owners, either wanting to take their property ownership to that next level or understanding how to buy those first couple in the most effective way, knowing that property is a long-term asset, and doing it right at the beginning can save a lot of heartache at the end.
Now, that's really interesting because I mean, before we had this chat, I was on my treadmill listening to a podcast and somebody else was saying, no, don't complicate things, make things easy. You don't need trust, you don't need structures. And I guess the answer is if only ever want to get to one or two properties and you are a PAYG earner, you're not in your own business, you don't have a lot of options, then I agree with that, that really if you're only ever going to own your home and maybe one or two investments, keep them in your own name. But if you are wanting to build a substantial cash machine, if you're wanting to pass on intergenerational wealth to your kids and your grandchildren, and particularly if you're wanting to secure your financial future in the longest holiday you're going to have when you retire and probably live longer than your parents and your grandparents did, it seems to make sense to plan for the future early rather than later, Ken.
That's right, because the cost of retrofitting a solution for most people is, can I say, unaffordable, and you don't do it. So it's better to get it right at the beginning and then leverage off that as your investments grow.
Sure. So the poor people think about today and what they're doing today and maybe on the weekend. The average Australian maybe thinks about a year ahead or two or three years ahead. But the successful property investors, business people, entrepreneur that we deal with at Metropole and also at Metropole Wealth Advisory, they're really thinking 20, 30, 40 years ahead. And so they're planning differently. So if you want to be in that group of people, I think you've similarly got to think about the long-term future, not just what's ahead this week.
And look, just as a quick example, I've been having more and more of these clients that, yes, they're a wage earner, PAYG, but as they move up that management scale, they take on different responsibilities in the business, occupational health and safety, is to name one. So therefore, they do have the potential of litigation. So even if you are only going to end up buying one or two properties, if your aspirations are to take you into a job with more responsibilities, you have to think about these things and, if necessary, take the appropriate action.
Sure. So go to metropole.com.au, have a look at our wide range of services, including starting with a strategic property plan or Ken Race's team's wealth advisory services to help you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth. Thanks for your time, Ken.
Thank you, Michael.
Well, it was a bit of a heavier chat today than some of our podcasts, and it wasn't really about property. But as a property investor, you have to understand the big picture, the macroeconomic factors that are going to affect our economy, our employment figures, what's happening with business, what's happening with consumer confidence. That's going to make you a better investor. That's why we discuss these issues regularly on the Michael Yardley podcast. And if you got some benefit from it, why not tell somebody else who you think would also benefit from it? Help me in my quest to make as many Australians as financially fluent as possible to help them build their wealth through property investment. Now, if you want to get a bit more information about wealth and property and finance, why not get a bundle of ebooks and reports? Go to podcastbonus.com.au, podcastbonus.com.au. I'll leave a link in the show notes where you can get a bundle of my ebooks, just as my way of saying thank you for joining us on the podcast. Now, in between my twice weekly podcasts, you can catch me on social media. Just look for Michael Yardley, or please join my private Facebook group, because when you do, you'll get something every day, a chart, a comment, something that I don't send elsewhere. So you'll have some exclusive contact with me. Just look for the Property Update Facebook group, Property Update as a private Facebook group, and join me in my journey. I look forward to catching up with you again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney Podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts. And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?